Wake up, everyone. It's time for the Steve Noble Show, where biblical Christianity meets the everyday issues of life in your home, at work, and even in politics. Steve is an ordinary man who believes in an extraordinary God, and on his show, there's plenty of grace and lots of truth, but no sacred cows. Call Steve now at 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Or check him out online at thestevenobleshow.com. And now, here's your host, Steve Noble.
It appears that there is more and more fire and smoke enveloping the very top of the building. And as fire crews are descending on this area, it does not appear that there's any kind of an effort up there yet. Now remember, oh my God.
Oh my God.
That looks like a second plane.
I did not see a plane go in. That just exploded.
We just saw another plane coming in from the side.
You did. That was out of absolute.
Yes, and that's
view.
The second explosion. You could see the plane come in just from the right-hand side of the screen. So this looks like some sort of a concerted effort to attack the World Trade Center that is underway in downtown New York.
Did you hear
the
explosion
is,
in your position?
Some
yes,
of the news
did.
Coverage
fact,
the morning of
we heard it.
9/11. And just a reminder, and I know it's kind of ad nauseum, right? We go down this road every year. We have the news coverage all day, and then Fox News does it in time. You look at the YouTube stuff, social media is full of posts about that. Never forget all the rah-rah, sis, boom, bah stuff, which I appreciate, which is important and good, but oftentimes we get kind of that 30,000-foot view of 9/11 and the days ensuing, and we don't often get from kind of a frontline perspective. So today, I just every year I'm kind of struggling and wrestling with what I want to do with the show. I have a very personal story from that day. I ended up down at Ground Zero with a firefighter and the widow of a firefighter that died on 9/11, but that was on November 9th of 2001. So it was about 2 months later. Then today, I was looking on Facebook, and Sloan Rackmans has been on the show before, of course, and we've been talking about different issues. And all of a sudden, I see your post, Sloan, and welcome to this show. It's great to have you in the studio. And I'm like, whoa, okay, you were there just a couple days after. Literally, you were there on the 13th of
yes,
September.
That's right.
And I was like, I got to hear this story. And they're volunteering with the Salvation Army. And you were 29 at the time. I wasn't. I was a few years older than that. But it completely changed my life. It had a huge impact on my desire a couple years later to become an activist. But these are stories that are up close and personal. We were both there. You were there a little ahead of me, but experiencing life at Ground Zero in the days that after. So we'll unpack that. Let's unpack kind of how you got involved, where you were that day, 9/11, and then me as well. And then we'll kind of go back and forth and share our stories, because I don't know your story and you don't really know my story. But everybody should hear these stories. Whether it's Sloan's story or Steve Noble's story, we all need to continue to tell these stories and hear these stories. And after my day there on November 9th of 2001, at the end of the day, I kept saying this guy, Tom Denard, was the firefighter that was with me all day. And I kept apologizing to him for taking his time. And by the end of the day, he was getting kind of ticked off at me. And he said, listen, Steve, if you say I'm sorry one more time, I'm going to smack you across the face. But do me a favor. I mean, if we could, we would drag every American we could and bring them here and spend a day so they can see this, smell it, experience it. But you have to make me one promise. And I said, okay, fine. What is it? And you name it. And he goes, never forget. He gave me a hat that said never forget. He said, don't forget. That was his number one request for me of that day. So let's go all the way back, Sloan, to 9/11 that morning. Where were you? What was going on? And how did you respond to what you saw?
Well, I lived in Charlotte, North Carolina at the time, and like everyone else, was preparing for myself for work, and someone called me, flipped on the television, and I saw the first, I saw what happened after the first plane had hit, and went over to some friend's house, and by the time I got there, the second plane had just come in, and that's when it dawned on me, and I think everyone else in this country that we were under attack, and it was horrific to think of the inevitable carnage that we were going to have to deal with as a country.
Yeah, and politically, I was an uber conservative at the time, but you were a liberal.
I was a far left activist at the time,
and it's interesting but encouraging that we both had the same basic reaction, because at that moment, that morning, that day, your political affiliation didn't really matter.
Not a bit.
It was just about being an American.
100%.
Which I think is gone. Do you think that's gone? Or do you think it's still there? Where something like this would galvanize the country and we would all set aside all these differences, some significant ones and important ones, but all of a sudden, it's just about being an American.
Oh, I know it would. I've seen it. I've lived it. I've seen it. I've lived it. I hope it doesn't take another 9/11 or something. You know, I was also at Boston getting ready to sit down on the by the finish line when the Boston Marathon attack happened.
Were you really?
Uh-huh. They call me the Grim Reaper in my family.
Jeez. No kidding.
So, yes, I mean, there's a helping spirit in every American, and I don't care who they are, and I've seen it. I mean, there's a tiny minority that's showing their behind right now, but because I've lived it, I know it's there.
Yeah, 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 and that's an important reminder. I can be such a cynic, which is one of the reasons I think I'm on the radio, but I can be so cynical and so quick to want to cast it all off, but thanks for saying that. And I think one of the things we experienced that day, and certainly you took action on it faster and more significantly than most of us, was the desire to do something. So kind of walk us through your thought process that day, because it didn't take you long to get into kind of action mode.
I can't explain why I did what I did, but I've never volunteered. I'd only been to New York a handful of times. I just knew I had to do something. So I picked up the phone. It was maybe 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and called Salvation Army. And, I said, if I, you know, come there, can I volunteer? And they said, absolutely not. I said, perfect. I'll see you in a few hours.
had you ever done anything with Salvation Army before?
Never, never.
That was just,
God, that was God.
Came to your mind.
As we know, I mean, when God, you know, wants you to do something, he works through people.
Yeah.
You know, and he, even though I didn't realize it at the time, he was calling the shots, for sure. So I got in my car and I drove to Raleigh, which was about a 2.5 hour drive for me. And then I got on a Greyhound bus and it took me hours to get there. And I had the Greyhound bus drop me off at, I think it was Penn Station. And I took a cab to 14th Street. Salvation Army headquarters. As you can imagine, it was mass chaos. There were
mass chaos because this is the 13th, 2 days later.
This is the morning of the 13th.
And there you are. So they said
no.
You said yes. God obviously said yes. Get on a drive up to Raleigh, get on a bus. Were there people on the bus? Were people talking about it?
You know, everyone was talking about it. Nobody was going up there. But I do remember a bus full of people of all colors, shapes, sizes, et cetera. I told them I was going to go volunteer, and they gave me a standing ovation. It was amazing. We were all Americans.
Talking
we
to Sloan Rackmuth. This is Steve Noble and the Steve Noble Show on 9/11. We'll be right back. So what are we waiting for? Welcome back to Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show today. Finally in the studio, Sloan Rackman's been on the show a couple times. Pen and Shield Media, she's been on talking about some of the hot-button issues, especially in the school system, so we'll continue to follow up on that and everything going on there, especially how BLM has kind of impregnated the school system. What that's not only BLM stuff, but Marxism, so we're going to continue to talk about that and appreciate you coming in today. It's kind of a last-minute thing. I saw your post on Facebook. Sloan was actually in Charlotte on 9/11. Called the Salvation Army. She's like, do you need any volunteers? They said no. Sloan's a type A doer, so she's like, whatever. So she drives from Charlotte to Raleigh, gets on a bus, takes the bus up to New York, and then shows up there at Ground Zero on September 13th, literally 2 days later. And so you just kind of made your way. Did Salvation Army have like a tent set up, or take us into that first day and when you first showed up on site?
Well, it was chaos. I mean, there were donations, I mean, really lined up all over the sidewalk. I mean, people were very generous in this country, obviously. There was a line maybe 50 people long wanting to do something. New Yorkers are great people, and so it was very crowded. And I'll never forget this. I went up to the front of the line to – I have three Johnny friends from New York, but Johnny was very flamboyant. He sang in the Harlem Gay Men's Choir. But I told him, I said, I just came from North Carolina. You're bringing me down there right now. He goes, I love your attitude. You're in. I'm like, great. Well, I didn't really know what I was in for, but what they put me in was a refrigerated truck. So I stayed in the back of that and made our way to, I didn't know where I was going, but no windows, right? So we took a 20-minute ride from 14th Street to Chambers Street. where I was across from World Trade Center 5, I think, 5 or 7, which was still on fire.
Yeah.
So that, still on fire, that was where my first tent was across the street. But when they opened the back of the truck, you can't prepare yourself for what you see. And there was no turning back at that moment. I was in the back of the truck with 15 guys who had already been made several. I found out what the refrigerator truck was for, actually, going back and forth to the morgue, which is what I spent a couple days, unfortunately, doing. So when there were recoveries, we would do that. But it was, you know, things got very real very quickly.
Was that adrenaline shock? Because did you hold it together? Did you lose it? Like, at what point did
never
your emotions
come?
You never did. Just kind of stayed in the groove.
Never lost it. I mean, you're working with people. Like I said, there's very, very small group of civilians allowed there, period.
Yeah.
And you really, it's like being in war, I would imagine, because you don't have any track of time. You just do. And there was so much to do, especially in the first couple of weeks. As you mentioned, it was recovery.
You had a sales job.
I did.
So what happened with your job?
I stopped. I left everything. I moved to New York. I ended up moving there. Mm. I just, nothing in my life had meaning anymore. After you see that, it's sort of like going into war. It's what vets probably experience. Yeah. When you've been on the other side of the wire, You can no longer relate to anyone that hasn't been through it.
Your perspective's completely, your paradigm changes, everything changes.
100%.
And so you stayed up there. And how long were you there the first stint?
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But then you actually were spending time there for the next, 6 months?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so when you're up there early on, to fold my story into it, you know, we're watching from afar and everybody's in shock. And then, of course, when Bush shows up, which didn't take long, and then the whole, they're going to hear from everybody soon, and we're all getting fired up for that. The unity around the country was amazing. Churches are full. I'm sure synagogues were full as well. People came, so you see this kind of interesting little revival thing going on. But there was this desperation of having to do something. I mentioned my buddy off the air during the break who worked for me, and then he had his own business, and he was a former Navy SEAL. And they're like, okay, we got to do something. And hey, maybe we can. We both owned house painting companies. So maybe our guys will work for free, and we can raise some money. We'll get some free paint from Sherwin-Williams. Little plug for those guys. They were happy to oblige. And so we painted a couple houses, and we had like $4,000. Then it was like, okay. Early on, you remember this when Bill O'Reilly started to ask the questions about where's all this hundreds of million dollars, where's all this stuff going? So I was like, there's no way I'm going to give this money to charity.
I wasn't watching Bill O'Reilly at the time.
Oh, that's
I was
right.
A liberal.
You were a liberal.
I was a liberal.
When did you switch? And did this factor into your ideological switch?
When I moved to New York, I read three newspapers, New York Times, New York Post, and New York Daily News. Now, two of those are rabidly liberal.
Yeah.
One's conservative. And I just kept listening. And when I was driving back and forth also from North Carolina to New York, which I did a couple times, I listened to Rush Limbaugh. Never listened. Never before.
Yeah.
And I had a battlefield conversion, actually, to conservatism. But it was from reading what I later found was garbage and came to know is you know, rational truth. Yeah. Took me about a year.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, wrestling with that. So so we decided, okay, we got to find a way to give the money directly to a widow. We're going to bypass all this other stuff. And so I called my dad to explain that to him. My dad was always a guy, sales guy. Call the president's secretary. That's how you get to any president of any company. Call and ask for his secretary as assistant. That's how you get to the top. So he said, well, call the mayor's office. Yeah, sure, Dad. Hey, Rudy, that's a house painter down here in Raleigh. I need some help. But that's what I did. And the mayor's office pushed me over to some other thing. And we're trying to find a Hispanic firefighter that died. And hopefully that, sadly, but that had children. So eventually, after a couple weeks of this game, I talked to this gal named Fran at the Hispanic Firefighters Association. And widows. And she just starts naming names. And one was Rodriguez. And somebody said, hey, didn't Evelyn Rodriguez just have a baby? Now, our third child was born on Valentine's Day of 2001. So I had a baby at home.
Wow.
So that one stuck to me.
Yeah.
baby, just born right now. I mean, since 9/11 and her husband died. Oh, my goodness. So, hey, did you catch that? Yeah, I'm right done. Okay, that's all I can do for you. Click. She's gone, right? Great representative, a tough New Yorker. So then I go online, and I shared this with you earlier, and I'm trying to figure out, how am I going to find this guy? All I got is Rodriguez, 343 firefighters that died from the FDNY. It's New York City, and I got to figure out which Rodriguez it is, because certainly there's going to be a bunch of Rodriguezes. I ask questions all the time when I tell this story and say, how many Rodriguezes do you think died that day? Your guess was 20. The answer is one. Anthony was the only one. So like God was moving you, God put Anthony Rodriguez on my radar screen.
Absolutely.
And so we were able to eventually get through the FDNY. I was able to, the guy I'm talking to, another lesson from my dad. When you're in a negotiation, whoever talks first loses. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking to the FDNY. I'm like, I really want to get to the firehouse so I can give this money directly to his wife. And the guy's like, well, we're not actually allowed to give out the firehouse phone numbers, the interior firehouse phone number. I can't give you that number.
Super helpful.
And I said nothing. And he goes, but you know what? Screw it. I'm going to give it to you anyway. So he gave me the number. So then I called firehouse and got it arranged. So on November 9th, we drove up on the 8th to see my sister and her husband and kids lived outside of Philly, got on the train, and showed up in downtown Manhattan on November 9th, just a little while after you. But the signs were still up. The pictures were still up all over the place.
Yeah.
So when we come back, let's talk about kind of progressing forward. Mm-hmm. And some other things, just some stories that you experienced, people that you met, how that impacted you. I'll fold my story in there. And then we'll talk about the impact on America. And I want to come back to, is there hope for us? Can we see that kind of unity again? Or are we just the divided states of America? And that's the deal. We're talking to Sloan Rachmeth from Penn and Shield. This is Steve Noble on the Steve Noble Show. Hang in there. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show, taking some time to revisit 9/11, which I have to do every year. I made a promise to a firefighter in New York, Tom Denard, who was in Engine 161 and Ladder 231, I think, in Brooklyn, right by Red Hook, which was known as the most violent housing complex in all of America at the time. And they were like three blocks down from the housing complex. And so he's the guy that picked me up that day when I took the train in on November 9th. And spent the day with me. We had painted some houses. We had $4,000 check ready to go. My wife bought some clothes for Evelyn Rodriguez's daughter, although we didn't know that it was a girl versus a boy. And had written a letter, took some pictures, because I did not expect to meet Evelyn that day. Her husband Anthony had died on 9/11. Was a probie with the fire department. And so he picks me up right outside of Grand Central Station. Stops in the middle of the street. All the traffic stops because he told me, I'm like, dude, how am I going to get to you? He goes, I'll pull up in a big white FDNY van. I'll stop in the middle of the street. Everybody will stop. He goes, we can pretty much do anything we want to right now in New York because everybody loves us. So I'll just pull up and stop. You come out and jump in. So that's what I did. And we're taking off. And I knew we were going to, I asked him, is there any way we can get to Ground Zero? And he said, yeah, if you want to go in there, I can get you in there. But you got to do exactly what I tell you to do because most people can't get in there. So you don't say a thing. Just let me handle it. Okay, fine. And so we're heading that way. Then he jumps on the Brooklyn Bridge. I'm like, okay, I guess we're going by the firehouse. Then he's showing me, okay, right over, see that? That's the housing complex. That's Red Hook. And the station's right by there. But then we blow by the exit. And I'm like, Tom, where are we going? He goes, oh, we're going to Evelyn's house. Now, I didn't know I was going to meet her.
Wow.
Right? So then I'm just in shock all of a sudden. Wow. What am I going to say? I was not an activist at this time. This is 2001. I didn't really become an activist in 2004. I hadn't even been on a foreign mission trip yet, so I had never really been out of my comfort zone much. And so we ended up at Evelyn's house for about an hour and a half, and she's got her daughter, who was born on September 14th. They were supposed to have a C-section on the 12th. Anthony died on, obviously, 9/11, and she said to the doctors, I'm not coming in until Anthony comes home. Well, Anthony wasn't coming home, obviously. And they're in this tiny little row house. And that's when I asked her, hey, what's going on financially? And she said, well, you know, there's all this money and all this money going to... She goes, but we haven't gotten anything. I haven't even gotten his paycheck. Mm. I go, what? So gave her the money. And then we went back to the firehouse, spent a couple hours at the firehouse. And then he took me into Ground Zero. But I was there, obviously, after you were. So going through that every day, you were working in the cold storage truck and that was making runs to the morgue.
Right. That's one thing. I think the most difficult thing I did And I didn't anticipate doing this because I had experience at that time in the OR is why, you know, I was doing that early on.
Yeah.
But one of the toughest things was there was a setup, a huge setup down by I forgot where it was. I can't even remember, but it was a setup where Salvation Army would disperse funds to family members who needed it, family members who had lost their husbands, wives, whoever. And so I'd have to sit at a table, just like you and I are, and interview the people and hear who they lost, et cetera. It was a difficult thing for me to do. But there was a story of a little girl who was brought in by an uncle, but her parents had both died, and grandparents, because the parents had come in to see and to visit their children who worked at
Cantor Fitzgerald up top, or were they?
Yeah, they were having breakfast at Windows of the World. Yeah,
the world.
And they were all having breakfast at the time. So she lost her grandparents and her and she was 7 or 8. And I, you know, I mean, there were very few times that I fell apart during this. I don't know why. I guess I just couldn't. I think that was a huge moment where I realized that this is. You know, the people that had perished, I mean, that's not where the suffering is, really.
Yeah, that's right. It's everybody that's left behind.
Yes.
Man, unbelievable. And so what were the people like that you were working with? I mean, obviously, you're down there in the mutt and the mess with all these
people. Hilarious. Well, when I first went down, and I told you about Johnny.
Yeah.
Okay. He called himself Johnny Ferry. He called himself that. Okay. There were many Johns there. So the first day that I was working there, you know, I met John and Denise Luttry, and they're fabulous. Johnny owns a big building in Chinatown, and him and his friends, who are my friends now, they're wonderful people. Mm-hmm. I think they're listening today.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, hey, Debbie, hey, Steve.
That's awesome.
So they said, you were staying with us. They forced me to stay in Chinatown with them, which I love, and every time I'm there, I mean, I go there all the time. And but they owned several, you know, they owned the building, so I stayed there. And we, you know, I can remember, I mean, we would walk, you know, from the site and have dinner in Little Italy every single night.
Wow.
And just, you know, catch up on things. And, you know, it's everyone was grieving, but I will say this. I mean, every single day that we left, I mean, we would have throngs of whenever we were driving back and forth, people cheering for us. It was, you know, you'll never experience anything like that.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
What a crazy contrast that there's carnage and death and destruction, but yet at the same time, those crowds were there. Because when I was there on November 9th, and Tom, we were finishing up. We were right down in Ground Zero. Actually, while we were there, we're standing on that little deck. So Rumsfeld and those guys used to do their interviews from this little deck right across the street from Ground Zero. And we ended up there. That's where we were inside. And there's people had written little notes all over the handrails. These are all pretty much family and friend that got in there. And reading those notes, just heartbreaking. And then all of a sudden, I look a couple feet to my right, and there's all these really intense private security guys. And I look back over at Tom to my left, and I said, well, it looks like some VIP is showing up. And he's like, that happens all the time, whatever. Okay, so a few more minutes go by, and now there's more of them up there. And I look to my right, and literally from me, maybe a little past the wall, maybe 8 feet away, I'm like looking over, and I said, hey, Tom. What? I said, that's Benjamin Netanyahu.
Really? Wow.
And I'm looking at him going, Tom's like, what? I said, yeah, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister from Israel. And Tom goes, holy blank, he's probably not a very safe person to be around. Let's go. So that's when we left and walked around. We went down. Did you see where the firefighters and the policemen set up their little memorials where family would come and bring cards and pictures?
They were all over. I mean, there were several.
And there was another one where there a bunch of family members from the airplanes where there's like teddy bears everywhere.
Yes.
And we
it was
were
by
there.
Trinity Church.
Trinity Church.
Yes.
And he's taking me by all these places. But the one for the firefighters and the police officers, I mean, I've got pictures of this, that kids writing cards to their dads and their moms. And it felt like I was invading somebody's personal holy space.
Oh, it was sacred ground.
Oh, my goodness.
Very much so. I mean, you may have been there while the pictures were still up, but when I first got there, leaving the site and walking through the town, I mean, there were thousands of pictures that were posted at different places at St. Vincent Hospital, everywhere, NYU.
Just trying to find their loved ones.
Trying to find their loved ones. And, you would see that when you were walking out of the secure area. But being inside the secure area, I knew they were never going to come home.
Yeah, that's right.
And so,
what was the hardest thing you saw or experienced while you were there? You shared the story about the little girl who's, was it her grandparents that were up in the restaurant?
And her parents as well, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. But in terms of things that you actually, that you saw, setting that aside, I can't imagine anything be worse than that. But what, when you look back, what are some parts of it that you're like, yeah, I don't really want to go there much?
I would say, and I'll only share this because I don't want anyone to ever forget, I would say that seeing a flatbed truck loaded up with body parts was a very difficult thing to see. And I want everyone to know and understand this, that this country has so much respect for our people that, not to be macabre, but even the littlest body part that was found, everyone would stop what we were doing.
Yeah.
They would cover it with a flag, and we would salute. The dignity and respect that was shown is incredible. I mean, that's what's incredible about this country, the value of life that we have.
Yeah. When push comes to shove.
100%. But I think that was very difficult. I think it was extremely difficult to, going from inside of the site to outside of the site, it's something that it's difficult to, to explain to people.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was going back to the cheering that you guys experienced whenever you left the site each day. So I'm there on November 9th. Tom takes me all around Ground Zero, and he's taking me back to the train station. He's like, oh, I love this part. You're going to love this. Now we're 2 months past, right? And there's not
as
much activity.
West Side Highway.
Yep, West Side Highway, and he's taking me back to the train station. And all of a sudden, there they are. There's like 10, 11, 12. They're all sitting down. But as soon as they saw the van, they all get up. And they start screaming and cheering, and Tom's got his hand out the window. And he's like, yeah! And it's unbelievable. I'll never forget that. It was just an amazing moment. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show, 19th anniversary of 9/11. I was there on November 9th, but Sloan Rackmuth, my guest today here in the studio, she's been on before. The founder of Pen and Shield. She was a radical liberal. Now, how do you describe yourself?
I would say I'm a radical rationalist, I suppose. I don't know.
I love how you tie that together, going conservatism really is just rational.
It is.
Not unemotional, but not controlled by your emotions, but
correct.
Rational.
Right.
Which we like to think as we grow up, as we age, and as we mature. I can't remember the president that said, if you're 18 and not a liberal, you don't have a heart. But if you're 30 and not a conservative, you don't have a brain. Because
Must have been Reagan.
Most people live personally pretty conservative lives. But then you go into the political realm because they have to.
Indeed.
You can't live a liberal life and keep the lights on. The government can do it.
Unless you're wealthy. We've found, the stalwarts of liberalism are the wealthy elite.
Yep, that's right. So coming out of your experience being there literally months volunteering, and thank you and God bless you for your service, for all of that. That's really inspiring. Let's talk about how it then changed you, because you started reading more. You listened to Rush Limbaugh on one of your trips back down here to North Carolina, and you were a hardcore liberal activist. Were you a feminist, I would assume?
I was. I was an activist for Now.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, you're hardcore. You got the T-shirt, the keychain, the whole
100%.
Nine.
I was all in.
And then was it a pivotal moment, or was it kind of a slow transition where you were converted to the light side from the dark side, or what kind of happened there?
Well, I think when you go through something that jars you, and it certainly did me, it's a great time in your life because you are open to change. A lot of people go through, let's say, a divorce or something like that, and they go on a journey to find the truth. It was very important to me to find out why 9/11 happened, who was responsible, what happened in the chain of events. And once I researched that and I learned that the USS Cole, what happened, our docility, our turning our back on things and pursuing things that really don't matter and with respects to national security, I knew that the path I had been on wasn't the right one. And in terms of the feminist myth, that was a whole nother thing where I realized, you know what, this is really not effective. It's not good for men or women, because there's a role for men and a role for women, and it's been that way since time immemorial. Mm-hmm. And to try to re-engineer that,
yeah,
just, you know, sullies your experience here on Earth.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we do with that. We equate differing roles to differing value. But
right.
That's certainly not biblical. That's not what God was doing early on when he established the family and marriage and everything. You had different roles, not different values. The husband's not more valuable than the wife. The woman's not more valuable than the man, or vice versa. And then the world, of course, wants to screw that up, mostly because it's tied to God. So as you began to kind of come out of that, how did this is fascinating. How did Harvard get on your radar screen? Because you had a GED, right? Is that what you said earlier?
I did.
That's a normal path. GED, I mean, activists,
for me,
go help at 9/11, then go to Harvard.
It was weird. I'm not going to lie. I was a serial entrepreneur really at the age of 17. I'd already, formulated three businesses that were fairly profitable. So I loved to work. And that was always my thing. So the job I had at the time was six figures easy, a little beyond, it was very good.
Yeah, doing well.
Yeah, doing well, loving life, and didn't need to get any more than, what I had. But it wasn't fulfilling for me. There was something more. And originally I went back to school because I wanted to be a lawyer. I knew, or maybe a journalist, but I knew I wanted to do something to continue my service. And I knew that I needed a degree to do that.
Which came out of the soil of your 9/11.
Yes, it did.
Service down at the Ground Zero.
Absolutely. Money meant nothing to me at all. I mean, I just had to do what I had to do. So I began taking classes at a community college. Then I, went to NYU, non-officially, just to get some classes under my belt. And I applied to, I had an excellent personal essay. Great test scores, and
why Harvard?
I applied at several different schools because I'm one of the best. I applied to several schools, and they sent me the letter, and I said, what? Wow. It was great. I didn't know what I was in for then.
How old were you when you started there?
I was, 33.
They must have been intrigued by that. That had to be
it was
interesting
great
for them.
It really was. It was a great experience. I think I was the oldest. I went to actually Rivers Cuomo from Weezer, the lead singer.
Yeah.
Dropped out of Harvard, then went back, and so we graduated in the same class. I think we're the same age.
That's hilarious.
But
all you people that are clueless right now, Weezer is a band. Okay, really good one, by the way.
Indeed.
That's so funny.
Indeed.
And then what about when you started Pen and Shield, and then being a journalist and being active? Because again, the thing that's so cool about that, that all came out of the soil of you being up there serving on the heels of 9/11.
Well, it's interesting. I started Pen and Shield and became really an activist in writing when, actually it's 4 years ago now, we were living in Durham, and I have two children, and they were enrolled at a Jewish day school, private Jewish day school. And the day school, unbeknownst to me, had three activists, anti-Israel activists, who were actually Antifa at the time.
The Jewish day school.
That's right. That 100% correct. And when I found that out, when they took down the map of Israel, I came in. I said, hey, listen, I like what you have going on here, but it's not for us. My husband's Israeli. I'm Jewish. They called me a bigot. That was the first time I was called a bigot and an anti-Semite. Well, now liberals. Now
you're Jewish.
100%.
Hello.
100%.
Too many anti-Semites in the world.
It's a weird thing.
That's a weird thing.
But this private school sued us.
Golly.
And the rest
Yeah, is history.
Is history.
So, why are you optimistic about America? You've said that several times. I thanked you for that a couple minutes ago because I struggle with that myself.
I mean, I've always had uber leftists who respect the hell out of me. And I force them to. I mean, I think if you're very principled.
Yeah, you earn it.
You earn it. You do what you do, and you like it or not. And I think, you know, for me, that's the way I am. And I just, and when I think that being that way enables you to kind of rise above the wake, if you mm-hmm. will, because people know not to mess with you.
Yeah.
I'm fair, you know, but I'm tough. And I think that that's, if more people were that way, I think we'd all get along a lot better.
And we used to call that journalism.
Right. Yeah.
Like Tim Russert style journalism. I mean, everybody was afraid of Tim Russert. And he leaned left, but he didn't play his role that way. He's just straightforward journalism, get the facts, ask the tough questions, nobody's getting out alive. And that's pretty much, I think journalism is pretty much dead now. It's mostly commentary and a little bit of journalism.
It is. I love, my sweet spot is investigative journalism.
Yeah.
Going for things that people don't want you to know about. And you know, sometimes I have to work hard for it. Sometimes I really don't, which is sad. Ford Foundation. I've been going after Ford Foundation.
Yeah.
I mean, the second biggest endowment. And over the last 4 years, they spent $2 billion in the United States programming. And once we all see that it's going to one effort, social justice, no one's asking questions about that. Why not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why not?
Why not? I mean, this is huge.
Well, because
I mean,
the majority of the media is on the same team. That's why.
Right. You know,
100%. All depends on his ox is getting gored. So if it's helping you, you're going to keep quiet. And we can be guilty of that. And people complain.
Oh, I'm not.
People that would complain of too much executive order action by Obama. And then when Trump does a lot of executive order action, I'm like, okay, are you willing to put both presidents under the same microscope? Are you? Because that's intellectual honesty. So for me, as a Christian, I'm like, listen, I'm going to call balls and strikes based on the word of God. And I really don't care who's at the plate. Most of the vitriol that I get is when I go negative on Trump, which doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. And so people on my own Facebook page, you must be a liberal. I'm like, have you listened to this radio show for like 32 seconds? Because I'm obviously not. And it's just crazy to see that. But that's me. My allegiance is to the truth that we find in God's word. Then I try to apply it evenly across the board. And nobody gets out alive on that deal. Everybody's going to mess up at some point.
Well, no one's perfect.
That's right. Nobody's perfect. So are you hopeful for America's future? We got 2 minutes left.
I am. I mean, sometimes, you know, this may be this what we're going through in this social upheaval that's bought and paid for by Ford Foundation and others.
Yes.
This might be for some their 9/11, their moment of crystallizing. I mean, look, if you value life and you see the people that are being murdered right now on the street just because of their color of their skin or being in the wrong place at the wrong time by these thugs, if you value life and you're seeing that, that's every bit as tragic, you know, as a terrorist attack. It's mini terrorist attack. And I think and I hope and I pray that people are waking up right now.
Have you ever seen a presidential election? We do this every 4 years, right? Oh, this is the most presidential. This is the most important presidential election of a lifetime, blah, 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 blah. In this case, I'm actually down with that rationale. Charlie Kirk said it at the first night of the RNC. And I thought it sounded like hyperbole at first when he said Donald Trump's the bodyguard of Western civilization. And I was like, is that hyperbole? Is it just because it's the convention? And whether you like him or not, I think that's actually his role right now.
100%.
I think it's that important.
Warriors are never perfect. They're usually very imperfect,
yes.
And they have a lot of scars. You got to have a lot of scars.
Did you hear Joel Rosenberg the other day when he was on the show?
Yes.
He described watching the Trump presidency as making sausage.
Yeah.
It's kind of an ugly process, but you like the results.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, I'm with you, Joel. That makes a lot of sense to
chicken
me.
Chicken sausage for me. I am kosher.
Yes, of course you are. What a great point. Sloan, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your story today. It's been awesome. I really appreciate it. And again, thank you for your willingness to not take no as an answer. And you showed up and you served. Yeah. And it's inspiring and it's awesome.
Thank you.
And we'll do it again. We'll get you back in here again.
Good deal.
Okay, everybody. Thanks you for your time. Never forget. That's a promise I made. I'm sure Sloan has kept that promise as well, obviously.
Yes.
But never forget this day. So don't go to bed tonight without spending some time meditating on your freedom. This is Steve Noble on The Steve Noble Show. God willing, I'll talk to you again real soon.